I'm Mike Hudak, director of Public Lands Without Livestock and author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. Please see the book's website, westernturfwars.com, for information about the book. I want to tell you about the management of our public lands. And specifically, I want you to know why these lands are not being managed according to the laws that are intended to protect our natural resources for future generations. As I noted in my podcast about natural capital, these lands are repositories of clean water, fertile soil, native vegetation, and native wildlife. Public lands under the jurisdiction of the federal government are supposed to be managed according to the law-enshrined principle of multiple use and sustained yield. This basically means that the commodity-producing activities allowed on these lands, such as logging, mining, ranching, or recreation, are supposed to be regulated so that the resources upon which these activities depend are not degraded. And one measure of the resources not being degraded is that the commodity-producing activity should be able to continue indefinitely, at least at the current level, other factors being equal, such as climate, for example. Toward achieving this management objective, our government employs people who are highly trained in various aspects of natural resource management. These are people who've attained at least a bachelor's degree, and sometimes have earned a master's degree in such disciplines as hydrology, wildlife biology, soil science, forest management, and range management. These are the people who, after allegedly evaluating the natural resources, then decide how much timber should be cut, or how many cattle should be grazed. Let's assume for now the soundness of the science that is supposed to underlie these management decisions, and instead, I'll examine the extent to which this science actually plays a role in management decisions. Narrowing the topic still further, I'll focus on management that pertains to ranching. One important measure of our land management is the resulting condition of the land. Unfortunately, broad evaluations of land conditions by the government are not frequently performed. For example, the most recent comprehensive report of Forest Service rangelands was produced in 1988 by the General Accountability Office, or GAO as it's often called. And even this report is severely deficient because the Forest Service chose to limit its analysis to only 50 million of its acres that it regarded as being, and I'm quoting here, suitable for grazing, unquote. Another GAO report, this one concerning expenditures on the federal grazing program and published in September 2005, notes that at that time, the Forest Service managed almost 93 million acres for livestock grazing. So what's behind this discrepancy of 43 million grazed acres between 1988 and 2005? Could the Forest Service have added that extra area to livestock grazing in the 17 years subsequent to 1988? Could it have nearly doubled the acreage that is grazed by livestock? I find this possibility quite incredible, and suspect that in 1988, the Forest Service simply chose to underreport its acreage devoted to livestock grazing. In any event, the only land for which we have rangeland monitoring are those 50 million acres that the Forest Service in 1988 acknowledged were being grazed. Here's what the GAO reported about these rangelands. 23% of them were of unknown condition, and 41% contained less than 51% of the expected plant species. In other words, only about 36% of these lands are known to have been reasonably healthy, and only 14% of the 50 million acres was in the best condition category, what the Forest Service calls potential natural condition. This is the plant community that would ultimately become established in the absence of interference by man under the present environmental conditions. Now let's consider the condition of livestock-raised lands that are managed by the other major federal land management agency, the Bureau of Land Management, also known as the BLM. That same 2005 GAO report about expenditures on the government's grazing program states that the BLM devotes almost 138 million acres of its lands to the grazing of livestock. In the BLM's Public Land Statistics Report for fiscal year 2007, we learned that 53% of these lands, approximately 73 million acres, an area the size of Arizona, had not had their condition evaluated by the BLM. Of the remaining 47% of their lands, 56% of the area contained less than 51% of the expected plant species. Only 8% of the land area was classified as potential natural community, a designation that is identical to what the Forest Service calls potential natural condition. This, of course, is an assessment of just the vegetation. But what are the consequences for the native animals that depend on this vegetation? Well, We've got about 151 species known to be impacted by ranching that have been federally listed as threatened or endangered, are candidates for listing, or have been petitioned for listing. And the primary way that these species have been impacted is through the degradation of the vegetation on which they depend for cover, nesting, and forage. Fish are additionally impacted by structural changes to stream beds, but even these changes often begin with extirpation of vegetation by cattle. Based on these statistics, what can we say about the long-term management of the lands that the agencies have inventoried? Certainly, we can conclude that their management has been ineffective at producing much land in healthy condition. But the question still remains, why has that management been ineffective? I believe that some clues to the answer can be found in remarks by people who I interviewed for my book, Western Turf Wars. For example, let's consider a comment by Larry Walker, a retired range conservationist whose career at the Oregon Office of BLM stretched from the early 1970s until 1997. Here's what he observed about the change in attitude that occurred within the agency when the conservative administration of President Reagan came to power in 1981. The policy that they tried to, well, I won't say it was a policy, but it was said a couple of times that what they would have liked would be if all the pickup keys in BLM offices were hung on the wall or locked away so they couldn't get out and see what was going on, unquote. Although that's only one comment by one person from one location, I think you can imagine how the desires of high-level political appointees in Washington, D.C. can set the tone for how policy is implemented throughout the nation. And if the intention of politicians or high-level officials is to ensure that on-the-ground activities like inventory and monitoring are curtailed, what better way of achieving that objective than by habitually underfunding these activities? Another one of my interviewees spoke about this very topic. Julian Hatch is a native of Utah, who's lived in the southern part of that state since the early 1980s. He became interested in environmental issues only after trespass cattle repeatedly ravaged his private land. Here's what Julian had to say about the management of cattle at the Grand Staircase National Monument near his home. What the government basically does is understaff or underfund these kind of positions. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's something like 90 positions they're supposed to have here at the Grand Staircase. I think they have only 40 or 50. They don't have the funding for the rest. They, of course, fund the grazing, but they don't fund other things. And that's all political. That's what it comes down to, the Republican Party and the ranchers that control it. They want to have it just the way they've always had it, which is to do what they want to do, until, of course, there's some government money. Then they want the government money, but they want it without strings. I understand that. I do think, though, that these government people have a responsibility and a duty to the public, to the taxpayers, to the government, to the landscape, to try to do the right thing. I think that some of them try to do the right thing, but it's overwhelming, the political problems they have. Unquote. What could these political problems possibly be? Again, we can gain insight from the remarks of people I interviewed for my book. Don Oman had been with the Forest Service for more than 20 years when he came to southern Idaho as the new district ranger in 1986. During our interview, he told me about a political problem of the sort that Hatch may be hinting at. And I'll just point out that in this quote, Oman uses a bit of jargon in his use of the word congressionals, by which he means a letter of inquiry from an elected official, such as the local member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Here's what Oman said to me. As we went around and looked at allotments, there were livestock, mainly cattle, still on the forest 2 weeks after the two-week extension they'd been given. And yet there was damage, severe grazing and impact to streams all over the district. So when we told ranchers they had to actually get their cattle off, it was the first time they'd ever been told that. They'd always been allowed to just let them drift with the snow, apparently. So that generated some of the first congressionals that we got. We told them that they had to get their cattle off immediately, and that the way things would work in the future was that there'd be no extensions unless they were deserved, which included no large areas of real heavy use, and that they had followed the operating plan for the year. Moved the cattle from unit to unit, cleaned the units, and operated like they're supposed to. Of course, we were informed it had never been done that way. They'd always been allowed to get most of the cattle off, and the rest would just drift with the snow. So they immediately started talking to my boss, the forest supervisor, and politicians, the congressmen and senators, county commissioners. And so the ranchers immediately applied pressure to try to avoid the limitations that next year. That first year, the area had been hit so hard in the past that we told them that we felt they needed to be held off 2 weeks that spring. Go on 2 weeks later, and we'd see about giving them extra time in the fall. But they needed to give the area a break and get it started better. It was a late spring. Well, they just had a fit over that, the one allotment we were dealing with there. And so we compromised and went back to a one-week delay in the spring. We thought they'd agreed to that, but then we got congressionals in from one senator and two congressmen complaining about that and inquiring why we would do such a thing. And as always, not a true inquiry, but a defense of the ranchers and a pressure tactic to get us to let them do what they wanted. Unquote. Oman's remarks reveal the more obvious aspects of intimidation that ranchers initiate. But he leaves unanswered the question of why Forest Service officials should care that ranchers have enlisted members of Congress as their advocates. The answer is provided to us by Bob Phillips, a retired U.S. Forest Service fisheries biologist who had previously held positions at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Here's what Phillips said to me. If the agency personnel, the forest ranger or the manager for BLM, are trying to protect the land, then they become an obstacle to the rancher leaving his cattle out there. The rancher then complains to his congressman that the district ranger is uncooperative. And so the congressman then goes to the chief of the Forest Service and says, this manager is uncooperative, and so on. The administrators of the Forest Service and the BLM in Washington, D.C. are beholden to Congress for their budgets. So the Congress has a tremendous amount of leverage on the agencies to do what a congressman wants. And the congressman wants the folks back home to be pleased with the management there, because that goes a long way toward ensuring his re-election. And in my opinion, most politicians only look as far ahead as the next election. So it corrupts the system, and the land is abused. One story that I heard from a friend who worked in the Washington office shows the kind of control Congress has on the agency. There was a congressman from Mississippi who had a disagreement with an assistant secretary of agriculture, and the assistant secretary did not roll over and obey what the congressman wanted him to do. So when the new budget came out, there were no funds for the position of this assistant secretary of agriculture. The congressman was able to just eliminate his position. And that kind of message, of course, becomes widely known within the agency. So there's no question that agency people realize the power that the rancher has working through his congressmen and senators in terms of calling the shots on land management decisions. Unquote. Merely the implied threat of financial retaliation is probably sufficient to destroy the environmental inclination of most on-the-ground managers. But for those managers who stand up to this sort of intimidation, members of Congress have yet another tactic that they can bring to bear on behalf of their rancher constituents. I'll let Doug Troutman, a retired BLM wilderness specialist, explain what I'm talking about. Here's what he said. One of the things that did happen while I was at Havasu was that Gary McVickers, the BLM area manager down south, ran afoul of some ranchers whose cattle were in trespass, and that brought in the Arizona congressman. I can't recall his name right now, but he demanded that McVickers be removed because he was bugging the cattlemen. They did end up moving Gary out of the area. Bob Buffington tried to support him, but there was a lot of pressure brought to bear on the BLM not to interfere with any of the grazing operations. Bob was a pretty good guy. He had a real strong resource ethic. There were several situations where he was ready to roll on things, involving miners and cattlemen, that people didn't think were politically astute. Yet Bob went ahead and took action against them. After I left and came up here, Buffington ran into problems with the cattlemen out of the Kingman area. That's where Gary was, too. Bob ended up moving to Idaho as state director. Later on, he ran afoul of the cattlemen in Idaho, too, just by enforcing the regulations. Again, the congressional delegation stepped in, took things over, and Bob was moved out. Unquote. From Troutman's remarks, we've learned about the second primary way in which federally elected officials, acting on behalf of their rancher constituents, can manipulate the management agencies away from protecting our natural resources. And the use of political influence to intimidate land management personnel is not the only tactic available to ranchers. What we might call social pressure can also be applied. But I'll postpone speaking about that to a future podcast. One might ask whether there exists a remedy to the undue influence that ranchers can exert on the federal land management agencies. Well, my answer depends on what one means by a remedy. If a poorly managed grazing allotment is also home to a plant or animal that's been listed as threatened or endangered, then there's a good chance in some parts of the West that a lawsuit brought under the Endangered Species Act would succeed in forcing the agency to adopt better grazing management. But for all the poorly managed and environmentally degraded allotments that lack a federally listed species, or which simply reside where judges are partial to ranchers, an environmentally favorable decision will not be forthcoming from the court. If we desire a comprehensive remedy to land management that habitually favors ranchers at the expense of our natural resources, then we must look to legislative actions that will remove ranching once and for all from the public lands.